From WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I remember being incredibly sad the night the Carol Burnett Show left the air. It was the end of an era. It was also like saying goodbye to members of the family. For over a decade, she had produced one of the funniest programs ever on television. And although she is arguably one of the most talented women ever to appear on TV, the strength of her show was the fact that it was an ensemble effort. And what an ensemble. Harvey Korman, Tim Conway, Vicki Lawrence. They created thousands of memorable characters and seemed to know exactly what the other was thinking at any given time. Their brand of sketch comedy has rarely been equaled, but it did set the stage for shows like Saturday Night Live. Well, for the past several years, Tim Conway and Harvey Korman have been crisscrossing the country with a highly successful tour. Tim Conway and Harvey Korman together again. And this weekend, they play the Belk Theater at the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center for two shows. And in advance of their visit, we are privileged to have Tim Conway with us for the hour. Thank you for being here.
Goodness, I couldn't think of another thing to say. That's wonderful. Delightful to hear my whole career like that.
Well, I could read your resume if you'd like. I mean, I have the whole thing right here.
I wrote that myself.
Did you really?
I've already heard it.
No, you didn't.
But thank you so much. Yeah, for praising a program that I also agree with you. I think that was really kind of a landmark in the television business, an opportunity to work for 11 years for a wonderful lady like that. It's great.
Yeah, the opportunity to work for 11 years in television is a landmark.
Yes, yes, as you know. Yes, I worked, when I first started out in Cleveland, I worked, as you know, in this business, you work, when you're in a town, you work for just about every station in town because you keep getting fired and you go to another one and say, you know, I'm here as a new personality. And you keep exhausting it until finally you're on radar out at the airport and you go to another city.
Now you're reading my resume.
Right. But no, it was those. A job like that just comes along once in a lifetime, to be able to work with a lady who was that generous in the business. I mean, Carol was the kind of person who just, if something was funny, she said, do it. She didn't say, it's funny, I'm going to do it. And we just had a ball for 11 years, and working with Harvey, very poor performer, as you could see by some of those shows, laughing all the time, you know, totally
just couldn't stay in character. Yeah.
And Vicki, who became a wonderful sketch performer through that show, I mean, she came on as a scared little 18-year-old and went on to wonderful things on that show.
Yeah. You and Harvey Korman are appearing in 54 cities, doing more than 100 shows this year. You've been doing this touring show now, I understand, for 5 years. You're doing two shows here on Sunday. Whose idea was this torturous schedule?
Well, it certainly wasn't Harvey's. Harvey has not had an idea, I don't think, since I've known him. Harvey is a brilliant guy. He could do the New York Sunday puzzle in 10 minutes, but the man cannot tie his own shoes. You know those kind of people. And so it's wonderful. He's a hypochondriac, and he's obsessive. He's all of the wonderful things that a person like myself can pick on during the course of our lives and association. So I have tortured him probably for about 35 years now. I got custody of him when the show went off, so I'm hustling him around out here trying to get him a few bucks here and there. But we threw this thing together about 5 years ago, and it was so successful that we decided, well, we'll do a couple more that year. And the next thing you know, we're doing about 120, 25 shows a year. And it's really a traveling Burnett show. You know, we do sketches, and we have a girl who travels with us, Louise Duard, who does impressions, and she's tremendous. And so we do the characters that people expect to see, the old man and Tudball and Dorf and, you know, things like that. The Dennis sketch is one of the few sketches that we actually took from the show itself that we do. And it turns out to be, I must say so myself, a rather enjoyable hour and a half.
And was it like, just, you know, they say once you learn how to ride a bicycle, you never forget. Was it like just getting back on the bicycle, the two of you, the timing and the bits and stuff?
Yeah, I think the nice thing about this is not that we were ever restricted by management at CBS, because Carol never even allowed management to even look at the show until it was actually taped.
Wow.
So we didn't have anybody saying, oh, that's funny, that's not funny, take this in, put this out, and all that.
So she didn't have the Smothers Brothers clause then.
Yeah, right. But we had it for a different reason. We just, you know, we just said, we'll present this show, and if you think it's funny, put it on. And they did. So it it worked wonderful because it was there truly were no restrictions with us. And that's the way this is with the live show that we're doing, that we can go back to those days when we can do what we really thought was funny. And I think you can judge by the audience reaction that we've had in the last 5 years that it is entertaining. It's kind of a family evening. People who, like yourself, watched the Burnett Show when it was on, and then their children who were allowed to stay up on Saturday watch, and now their children's children are coming. So it's, 12-year-olds on up and a family afternoon where you can really sit down and enjoy yourself.
Now you appeared on... most of the major, I'm old enough to remember these shows, I'm sorry to say, but you appeared on most of all the variety shows, the Hollywood Palace, Gary Moore's show, which is where Carol started, Glenn Campbell, Sonny and Cher, Sammy Davis, Kraft Music Hall, etc. But Carol Burnett's show is the one that I think almost everybody remembers above and beyond all of these shows. And Sonny and Cher was a great show. It was like a junior Carol Burnett show, actually. But what was it? What was it about the Carol Burnett show, do you think, that was so special?
Yeah, I think one of the main things, and Carol designed it that way, was not to be offensive. We never offended a person or, maybe we did in a sense, a product. I mean, we always used to do takeoffs on products and things like that. But if we made fun of anybody, we made fun of ourselves making fun of something. But, people who make mistakes in their lives nowadays are just trampled in the Inquirer and the Star and everything until their lives are just really totally ruined. And a lot of television in those days was a little mean-spirited from time to time, but Carol never believed in that. So we kept a very wide audience. We just did funny for funny, and we got dressed up in crazy outfits and mustaches and accents and did what we thought was amusing on a Saturday.
Why is that not there anymore? Why are shows like that gone, do you think?
I don't know, really. A variety, when we were doing the show, there were, I guess, a dozen or 15 shows on at the same time that were variety. But I think it's difficult. I don't think you'd ever get a network nowadays to commit to doing it the way we did the Burnett Show.
How so?
We just knew what was funny, and we weren't looking for outside advice on what is funny and what's not funny. Nowadays, you go and there's four or five producers and a couple of dozen executive producers, and then all the way down, there's probably about 60 or 70 people working on a show with maybe 20 or 25 writers. And in our day, we had six writers, and we did a show once a week. And in effect, you did almost a Hollywood or a Broadway review every week because we did music and sketches and everything. So it would be too expensive for them to commit to something like that, I think.
And was the autonomy, because network television was a smaller, less monolithic, conglomerate animal, or was it because William Paley was in charge of the network and he knew Carol personally and gave her a free hand?
I think... in effect, CBS never expected the Burnett Show to go. They had an obligation to her to let her play off 13 weeks, or maybe it was even more than 13 weeks, when she came here on CBS. So she entered the show saying, look, I'm going to have some fun. We're going to try to make it funny. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So CBS put it on and never thought that it was really going to amount to anything. And the next thing you know, people started watching it, and they said, okay, well, let's give her the whole year, and they gave her the year. And by the end of the year, people got on to the fact that, hey, this is a little something unusual. And away it went, and it never stopped for 11 years. We never really got involved in ratings in those days. I mean, I never heard the word rating mentioned until probably about the last 3 or 4 years, and it was only because we were in the top 10 and 20 at that time. But as you say, in those days, there were three channels. And it was a family situation. I mean, when you watch television in those days, just because there were only three networks, you sat in front of the set. It didn't offend you. There was no nudity or language or anything like that. You sat with the whole family. You enjoyed it. You talked about it. You talked about it the next day. It was something to share with people. Nowadays, A little difficult to sit there with your family, I think, and watch anything.
Well, not only that, you have more than one TV set in the house, and they're
right.
all tuned to one of 800 channels, and they're all
right. Yeah.
And there's still nothing on. You know that? No. There's still nothing on.
You know, it is amazing. And when we spend a little time talking to the audience when we do this show, and we ask, you know, how many people are watching certain shows that are high-rated shows, you know, and there's about four or five people in the audience clap, and then you say, how many of you are watching TV Land? And everybody
yeah.
applauds, because it's kind of a little bit of a security, I think. I'd rather live in Mayberry, I think, than any of the other towns that seem to be picturesque, supposedly, nowadays on television.
Tim Conway is our guest. Tim Conway will be in town with Harvey Korman on Sunday at the Belk Theater in their show, their two-man show. Actually, it's a two-and-a-half-person show. It's a
yes,
two-man, one-woman show.
That's right.
Called Together Again, 704-372-1000 for tickets to that show, by the way. And there are two shows, one at 3, one at 7. Boy, that's like vaudeville.
Isn't it, though? Yeah.
Two a day.
You know, sometimes we do three shows, which is really,
really?
Vaudeville.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, why do you do that?
Well,
that's a lot of work.
I know. But, you know, as I say, it is fun. I mean, if we weren't getting the same reaction each show and you say, gee, that was kind of good. That was a good show. That one really stunk. We've never had that reaction. The audience does the same thing every time we do this show. I mean, first of all, we are really so welcomed by an audience, you know, because of what they remember from the Burnett Show. They anticipate seeing and hearing certain things, which we do, so mm-hmm. they're satisfied. It's like going to see Andy Williams and he sings Moon River. You know, you're happy. So if you didn't sing it, they'd be a little annoyed. But fortunately, we kind of give them what they want, so everybody seems to be pleased.
You know, I went and saw Seals and Crofts. They were a big hit musically back in the 70s, and they opened their set by saying, you know, we do all of our hits. And today, we're going to do some of our favorite songs.
Oh, well.
And they didn't do any of them, and everybody was angry. I mean,
I know. That's what you go for.
That's right.
So that's, you know, that's what we deliver.
How did you maintain the quality of that Carol Burnett? Because as you say, it's like producing a Broadway show every week. You had
yeah.
skit comedy, you had singing and dancing going on, you had all kinds of costume changes, and I know it was tape, so you could stop the tape if something went wrong, but how did you do it? What was your week? What was your week like?
Well, on Monday, we would come in and supposedly read the script, which we did. Then we kind of go to wardrobe and see what wardrobe they were going to throw at us, and maybe a mustache or a wig, and you'd thought of an accent or something. But by Tuesday, everybody had memorized, you practically memorized it as you read it.
Good
because
Lord.
It was so well written that you could just, as we were in the reading, you could visualize what was going to happen. You were thinking of a character or whatever. And so by Tuesday, it was pretty much all together. And I would say in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years of the show itself, we probably didn't rehearse 3 or 4 hours a day because it just fell together. We knew each other so well. We knew, and a lot of us, I was a writer on the show, so I could write one thing and say something else. That's why Harvey was always going south on me, because he would anticipate what was on the page, and I would throw something else at him. And even though I would keep within the script itself, we were going in a different direction. So
yeah.
that's why he was always standing there, you know, just with his pants off.
And we have to take a break here for just
yeah,
a second,
sure.
and we'll come back and we'll follow what happens during the course of the week. We're on a Tuesday now, so we'll be Wednesday when we come back.
Okay.
Tim Conway is our guest on WFAE.
Flight.
We were going through the remarkable work week of the company of players at the Carol Burnett Show, producing this show every Saturday night on television. And Monday you get the script, Tuesday you start rehearsing. And I even though you wrote some of this material, having done a little of this, to memorize those lines like that, I mean, you have to because you got some other things to learn. But how do you do it?
You know, now that I look back, I find it hard to believe. You know, first of all, I'm a little dyslexic. So I not only couldn't read the lines, I really almost had to memorize them just by the fact that I couldn't read. I mean, even if I didn't realize until I was on the show about 5 years that they actually had cards on the show with the lines written on them. I looked over one day and I saw all these lines written. I thought, gee, that must be Carol's dialogue or something. And I looked and mine was there too. But since I can't read, and on that show you couldn't really read lines anyway. You had to memorize them because the interplay of the characters was necessary. So, but it was so well written that you could actually, as I say, practically memorize it as you were reading through it. So by Wednesday, we all had memorized the script. We did a run-through in the afternoon. I said the network really wasn't allowed to see it until Friday, but they would come in on Wednesday and at least get an idea of what the show was doing and what it was about. They had no really contribution to it, but they saw it, so they knew what we were going to do. Thursday, we would come in and what they call block it, just stand in the areas where the cameras were going to be. And Friday, we would shoot it. So really, in reality, the only time that we ever rehearsed lines really were Tuesday and Wednesday, and that was maybe a couple hours on each day. So by Friday, that's why it remained fresh so much, because not only was it fresh to an audience, it was almost fresh to us. We'd never heard where the laughs are going to be or if people would laugh, and on occasion they didn't. You'd hear the air conditioner. We would, and then on Friday, we would shoot it twice, once in the afternoon and once in the evening, and we shot it as a live show, so we only stopped for set changes and costume changes. And a lot of times on Friday, we would do something in a dress rehearsal in the afternoon show that really wasn't working, so Joe Hamilton, who was the producer, would say, okay, look, Tim, you take Harvey's character, and Harvey, you do Tim's, and we'll just change those two characters. So I would have to do Harvey's lines. So you had maybe 30 minutes. I would memorize his lines. He would memorize mine, and we would go on and do it. But as I say, we knew each other so well. We knew that the comedy written was so solid that you could actually do that. So there was no sitting there, you know, trying to punch up something or do this, do that.
Now, what we saw on the show, was it the best of the dress rehearsal and the best of the final taping?
It was usually the air show.
Okay.
Because the dress show was the first time you actually heard an audience laughing, and you knew then where the laughs were. By the time, and anything that I was going to do to Harvey to kind of break him up, I would save until the air show anyway. So you didn't see it in the afternoon, and he never knew where I was going or what I was going to do. So by the time we got to the air show that night, it was, and that's why, you know, the cameramen would laugh, the stagehands, the audience, the producers, directors, everything would laugh, because they had never seen it. So most of what you see on the air was Friday night's show all put together.
Now, the first time that you deliberately threw a curve to somebody by ad-libbing something that had not been in rehearsal, did you do that because it was just spontaneous and you thought, that's going to be funny, or did you do that knowing that this might be an interesting thing to do?
You know, I have a funny attitude towards this business. I never wanted to be in the business. I was actually going to be a jockey.
Yeah.
I weighed 95 pounds in high school, and I was galloping horses at a track in Cleveland. So that was what I was actually looking to be in life. Had I not fallen off as much as I did in being terrified of horses, I would have probably been in the Hall of Fame there. But then once I got into the business, I just had this attitude of I was so happy to be there, and having been a big fan of Steve Allen and The Tonight Show, I loved staying up at night and watching that kind of a performance, and that was kind of the same kind of performance that you got on The Burnett Show, in that there was a lot of ad-libbing, and it was a live show every night, so they really, you know, had to do it every night. It was live performance, so I got into that groove of that kind of humor, and when I came to The Burnett Show, I had such a loose attitude. It wasn't like, oh, my gosh, this is a big break, and da-da-da-da. I was just so happy to be there that I felt a certain looseness that I could say what I wanted to say to Harvey or to Carol or to Vicky or whatever in a sketch and feel that, you know, nobody chastised you or nobody said, hey, stop horsing around. You know, so it was a welcome spot to do that. And the more the years went on, the more we did it. And when I became a regular for the last 3 years, it was just, you know, really fun and games by then.
And they say, you know, if you're an actor, they say never break character. Never, you know, if it's a comedy, do whatever you have to do. Bite the insides of your mouth.
Yeah.
Don't laugh. And there are some people who can do that. And there are some people who just can't. I know that Carol, you would watch her, and you would watch her struggling and struggling, which made the audience laugh all the more harder, which made her try to hold back all the more. It was just a snowball.
Right. Well, there was, Yeah, there were so many sketches that I look at nowadays where the four of us are standing on stage and all four of us are probably thinking the same thing. Why are there four adults up here in these costumes with these stupid wigs on saying these ridiculous things? And, you know, all of us have a smile on our face and all of us loved each other so much and appreciated each other so much. There was never really any arguing on that show. Carol, first of all, wouldn't allow that. If you had an argument, you got out. She created a very, very happy atmosphere, and it remained that way for 11 years. So, as I say, it was a playground. It was just like, come and put your costume on and an accent and be funny.
Now, I have to ask a question that I know is on the minds of a lot of people. And I saved it for the middle of the program so that I wouldn't make you hang up right at the very beginning of the interview.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Brace yourself now. Here it comes.
Yes, here I come. Okay.
This show was so popular and so groundbreaking and so record-setting that CBS keeps bringing you back to do retrospectives. And the 25th anniversary reunion, Showstoppers, which was on a couple of years ago, got 30 million people in the audience to watch it. It was the fourth highest rated show of the 2001 season. And since then, they have brought you back yet again for another retrospective, which I watched and enjoyed. I enjoyed both of these very much, but I kept sitting there thinking, darn it, I love these clips, but what I would love even more, since you're all there and you're all ambulatory.
To do it again.
To do it again. Just give me a new hour. Has that been tossed around?
Yeah, the first time, we actually had some sketches that we were going to do on that show. And then Carol said, you know, I'm not, after looking at all the clips and everything, she said, you know, I don't think we can do it any better than this. And I kind of disagree with that because knowing Carol, I know that she, you know, knowing all of us, I mean, we would all jump in and be right back where we were in a little different physical costume, obviously. But we would... You know, we would be back where we were, and I don't think it would be any fear of not being humorous, you know, as witnessed by the fact of what Harvey and I are doing now. But I think Carol just kind of wanted to keep it sacred and to what it was when we did it. On the second one, when they came to Carol to do the show Bump Up the Lights, CBS really came to her almost 2 weeks before we did it and said, could you possibly think of another way to approach this show? And she said, well, the only thing we haven't really played out of these are the questions and answers that we did in the front. So they said, well, you know, put it together. So we had no script or anything. We just came in, sat there, and talked a little bit about what that was. I mean, that was almost a throwaway, in a sense, for Carol.
And that was wrapped around that week
questions
of...
and answers.
Well, it was also that show kind of appeared about the same period of time on the CBS schedule as the Dick Van Dyke reunion. And that, you know, I love that show, and that was not a good show.
Yeah, well...
But you guys would be... Because you guys are all in good shape. I mean, you guys are still breathing!
That's true, yeah.
What am I saying?
Yeah. Well, no, that's true. I think what happened is that we did have so much fun, not only on that show, but in life, that I think we kept that humor. You know, you talk to Carol nowadays, you'd never know that it wasn't the same person that you saw on the air. Or Harvey. I mean, Harvey's just as grumpy and as annoying as ever, and Vicky's the same. Vicky's actually out doing a show with what she calls a two-woman show with one woman. She does Mama from Mama's Family, and also a live appearance with her, obviously with herself. So, you know, all of that, the memorabilia that came with that show is still in effect for an audience out there. And Carol still does once in a while. She'll go around and she does like a question and answer period with an audience and shows some clips and things. So all of it still works. And I think if we could actually talk Carol into doing some of those things, that I don't think would be any problem.
What's her number? I'll call her now.
Ah, believe me, we talk to her so frequently about doing that. It's unbelievable.
What about a Tim Conway, Harvey Korman TV special?
Well, you know, I know it seems silly, but I'm not sure we'd do it because I think you take such a chance nowadays on doing something like that because there are so many other outlets in television. But what hits nowadays on television is so bizarre from time to time. All of the reality shows, you know, the Paris Hilton show, things, you know, that you never would suspect in a million years would take off if taken off. So to come back and do a show and take a chance of it not really doing anything, plus the fact, obviously, I'm 70, what am I, 70? I'm 70. Am I 70 or 71? I'm going to be 71, I think. Harvey's 77, so it's, you know, it's hard to get a 30-year loan on your house at this age, and it would be difficult for a network to invest any time on anything outside. Maybe we could do 6 Feet Under for real.
Yeah, you know, there's great sketch material, it seems to me, in all those reality shows that you mentioned.
Right. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, we, you know, whenever we get together for dinner with Carol and Harvey and I, we often talk about what we would do if we were still on. I mean, there are so many things that are perfect targets now.
Now, your real name, I was surprised to find out,
is Betty. Yes.
Yeah, I was a little concerned about that.
I had some difficulty with
that.
You
know, but I'm glad the change came through okay for you, though. Yeah, you would never have known until you told me.
No.
No, Thomas Daniel Conway.
Right.
Where did Tim come from and why?
Well, when I came to do the Steve Allen Show, which was the first show that was actually that I had to join the union, there was another Tom Conway, who was George Saunders' brother, in the business. So you can't have two people in the union with the same name because you'd get each other's checks. And I'd like to get Tom's checks, actually. a name in the business has to be an individual name, whether it has a junior on the end or whatever it is, to make a distinction of between the two. So actually Steve Allen was the one who gave me the name. He said, why don't you just dot the O? So I made it Tim and got from Tom to Tim.
Now, Steve Allen was a groundbreaking person. Of course, back, you know, we look back on these people, and I love Steve Allen, and we look back on them and we think, genius. But I have met some people in those so-called golden years of television who have confided in me that what it really was is that they were making this stuff up. They were inventing this as it went along. They didn't know what was going to work and what was going to fail. They were just throwing things up at the camera and seeing what would stick. Was that the case with Steve Allen? Because a lot of what he did is being done today by people like Letterman and Conan and all these people. Some of the same bits.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, that was the key to television. I mean, first of all, there were three networks, so you only had, three audiences you could play to. But the key to it was that what writers were doing in those days was inventing television. When they came up with a situation comedy, that was the first time that we were actually looking at a situation that was comedic. So unless you went, you know, to the theater and saw situations that were funny there. But nowadays, writers who are writing shows about situation comedies and families and things are writing really what they saw on television that is supposed to be funny.
Yes.
So they're really duplicating. I mean, there isn't a show on the air that you don't think, gee, isn't that a character from the other show? I mean, they just really kind of intertwine through the whole
thing. Why do you suppose that is? Because, you know, you watch a Saturday Night Live show today, and almost every sketch is about a television program, or it's on a fake television program. It's all centered around television.
Right. Yeah, nobody's, well, because nothing's really left. It's all been done. And so the only opportunity writers have now to duplicate anything is to really duplicate it and all sit down and try to think of, you know, a funny husband and wife, two funny kids. I have 6 children, and they're in their 40s, and they've never said anything funny. So I don't know where they get these kids to play on these shows that are so amusing.
They're
and funny dogs and cats.
They're afraid to say anything funny around you.
That's right.
The problem. You've been in the business. I think I've read that you started on the Steve Allen Show in 1956, and you've done all these network shows. You were on McHale's Navy. You were with Carson. You were with Leno, Married with Children recently, the Bill Cosby shows, Touched by an Angel, which is the funniest thing on television. No, it's not. Not funny at all. It's a wonderful show, actually. Coached, Yes, Dear. How has the nature of comedy, or television comedy for that matter, changed over all those years that you've been involved in it?
Well, as I said, the staff has certainly grown. When we did the Burnett Show, we had a producer, a co-producer, director, and 6 writers. I did a show not too long ago. I swear there must have been 70 people at the reading, and everybody had a job. There were 21 writers on the show. But I've done shows. Well, we did the Burnett show and taped it probably in an hour and 20 minutes to an hour and a half, and that was an hour show, and that includes costumes and changes and everything. Mm-hmm. I recently did a show where I came in at 8 o'clock in the morning, and at 6 o'clock in the morning the next day, the crew finally quit and said, look, this isn't going to get any better. We're going home. I don't know about you folks. If you want to sit here and keep doing this, wow, fine. But it just, they will stay there all night putting in four words and trying to make it humorous, and it just never works. I think one of the funniest shows on television now is Everybody Loves Raymond.
Isn't that a great show?
It is so well written, but the cast, mm-hmm, has such harmony with each other. I mean, they have the same feel about doing their work as we did on the Burnett show, and I've seen them taped, so it is genuine laughter that you hear on that show. You don't hear a laugh machine filling, mm-hmm, in the holes there. They have such solid characterizations and writing and timing, and they're all just brilliant performers.
Yeah, I came late to that show, and when I discovered it, I thought two things. I thought I Love Lucy,
mm-hmm,
and Carol Burnett, because it's funny like Lucy, and it's the ensemble of the Carol,
right,
Burnett show, because you can tell that the actors like each other,
right,
and they all have a definite role, and they play it so well, and it is so well written.
It is supreme. It really is.
Conway is our guest. Tim Conway will be in town on Sunday with Harvey Korman in a two-person show with a third person thrown in, called Tim Conway, Harvey Korman Together Again at the Belk Theater. 372-1000 for tickets. We have to take a break. We're coming right back with more of Tim Conway, if he can stand it, in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I kind of asked you a question before the break about the nature of comedy, and I think I threw you a curve by throwing the word television in, because you're a stand-up comedian and you're a comedic actor. So you know a great deal about comedy, and comedy just in general, what's funny, has probably changed, or the way you present, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but the way you present comedy may have changed since 1956 when you started that. Has it? I mean, do you have to approach things differently? Is the material substantively different than it used to be?
Not really, because I've stuck with the same kind of comedy that I'm comfortable with. I refused a lot, not refused, I just didn't do a lot of things that were offered to me, because I felt that they were offensive to an audience, mm-hmm, that I was playing to. You know, I'm certainly not an angel in my personal life and probably should be in prison, but for the most part, when I'm presenting something to the public, I really don't want to, at the end, have to apologize for anything. So I stay away from language and jokes that, mm-hmm, are that off color. I mean, obviously, we do some jokes that when we're talking about age with Harvey and I that are a little descriptive, but we don't use language, and we don't, you know, it's really not offensive. There's a different way of approaching talking about certain things that can be humorous without being offensive, and I've always tried to stay in that area.
And you still get big laughs, right?
Yeah, and it relaxes an audience more. Yeah. They don't have to worry about you saying certain words or, gosh, mm-hmm, when am I going to have to cringe at this one? And, and nowadays when you get the improv folks together, you know, they string together about five or six offensive words, yeah, and there's nothing really amusing about what they're talking about, but the words are shocking, so people feel, well, I guess we better laugh here. And I've never subjected myself to that. So in my career, down through the years, as I say, I've refused to do a lot of things, and a lot of things in features that probably would have put me in a different place in this business. But I'm more comfortable doing what I'm doing, and I've, as I look back, I'm more proud of what I did than had I gone in the other direction and just submitted to what the industry is today. And the industry, you know, in the LA Times out here 2 years ago, the LA Times and all of the networks got together and printed the words that they were going to use in the next season so that they could compete with Fox all of the other channels that were allowed to use language. So when CBS says, we've decided that we're going to use the F word, and, you say, what the heck has television come to where we have to actually announce what we're going to do here? It just, to me, is silliness. You know, somewhere along the line, we just lost it. You know, I mean, sensibility and, you know, what's right, what's wrong, just went by the wayside suddenly.
Now, you're a comedy writer, which indicates that you somehow know in your heart or in your funny bone, wherever that is, that something is going to be funny. Is there a secret to comedy? I've heard some comedians say that certain words that begin with certain letters are funny and things like that.
Numbers
is there a secret
funny,
to it?
Yeah. No? I think there's a rhythm to it. And if you put the correct wording to that rhythm, normally it's going to come out funny. On the Burnett Show, most of our comedic reactions really enhance the lines. Good camera work, for one thing, but to capture some of the looks that were coming from us really punctuated, as they do on Everybody Loves Raymond. You know, when that camera hangs on Patricia or Ray or, you know, any of those characters, you can see what's going through their mind just by looking at their face. And that's why I appreciated Don Knotts so much, because in Don, you know, you just look at that face and you know what's going through his mind, whether he's being arrogant or he's being punished or he's sad or he's, you know, whatever.
You work with him for a while. What was he like? I interviewed him once, and he was in the studio live, and, of course, you know, the Andy Griffith Show is incredibly popular here still today in this part of the country. And it drew the biggest audience in front of the glass window I have ever seen. There must have been 100 people outside trying to get a glimpse of Don Knotts.
Yeah.
What was he like to work with?
He is Barney Fife in real life. I mean, he's
sorry to hear that.
He is, you know, you just want to take him by the hand and, you know, carry him around all day. He is a gentle man. He is funny. He doesn't try to be funny. He's just funny. That character of Barney Fife will never be duplicated. I mean, that you talk about an icon. I mean, that is really an icon in the business. And the camaraderie that they had on that show with Andy and Don and the rest of the cast, it just those are fortunate things that we have in our television keepsake scrapbook. That hopefully we'll be able to look at for a long, long time.
I want to come back to something we were talking about a second ago, and that is facial expressions, because it's all part of comic timing. And you and Harvey Korman, all of you did, but you and Harvey Korman stick out in my mind, quite honestly, because sometimes volumes were said with a look, and the audience would laugh, and then the look would change just slightly, which would cause the audience to laugh more. Gosh, that's an art.
Actually, probably those expressions come internally that you're not even aware of. Mm-hmm. When I look into Harvey's eyes, I mean, you can see what I'm thinking, and you can see him beginning to collapse. And I think an audience began to read that, and we didn't even realize that that's what was happening. We just thought, well, we're looking at each other. But when you look at it on television and you see what's going on, and not that we ever tried to do it or tried to duplicate that, it just happened naturally. I mean, here are two guys dressed in, one's in a lion outfit and the other's dressed as a makeup woman. You look at two people in their 40s, dressed as clowns here and looking at each other going, we should really get a job. And things go south on you, you know. So
But you know, real jobs don't pay like that.
That's right. Yeah, why should we go down to Sears and work when we can do this for a lot of money?
Is it true that you have no real formal training in this field?
That is correct, yes.
Then get out of the business, would you please?
Yeah, right.
How did that happen?
As I say, I just happened to be at the wrong place at the right time. Starting out to be a jockey, going from being a jockey, then I went to college, Bowling Green State University, which your Wendy, your assistant, went to. And as I reminded her, our fight song at Bowling Green State University was Isaac Izumba, which is Isaac Izumba, Zumba, Zumba, Isaac Izumba, Zumba, Zay, Isaac Izumba, Zumba, Zumba, Isaac Izumba, Zumba, Zay. Roll along, you BG Warriors. Now, if you have a fight song like that, how many games a year do you think you're going to win? We were 0-20 for each semester I was there. So I went to college, and I worked more in college than I went to school. I just, because I didn't have any money, so I had to have a lot of jobs. And I kind of talked my way through college. I went into the Army. I defended Seattle for 2 years. And as you know, we were not attacked at Puget Sound.
That's because of you.
Yeah. I came out, and a kid I had gone to high school with had a job at a local radio station. And he said, you know, Jack Riley, who ended up on the Bob Newhart show, was working for this disc jockey, and he was going into the Army. I was coming out. He said, why don't you go down and see if you could get the job? And he was writing comedy for this disc jockey in the morning. And so I applied, and the guy said, well, you got a sense of humor. Give it a shot. And I worked for him for about a year and a half. And during that time, I got into promotional work at the station, and the next thing I know, I ended up on some of the promotions for TV, and then I talked a local station into doing a talk show in the morning where I was the director. I wasn't even the talent, and a guy named Ernie Anderson, who was the voice of ABC.
Oh, yeah, I know Ernie Anderson. I knew Usher's, right?
He was the talent. He had very little talent. I had never directed, so the show really was a shambles. We were supposed to have guests on in the morning. The show was so bad we couldn't get guests, so I was the guest each day. And I would come out and he would say, hey, bullfighter, trumpet player.
How do you call cues? Ready, two, take one. How do you
do
that when you're on the set?
I just locked the camera on.
Oh,
okay. I just left it on and come out and sat down and talked. And then we showed movies. We were supposed to have a movie during this hour and a half, and I could never figure out how to back time the movie so that it ended at 10:30. So the first week we had no endings to the movies. I mean, it just kind of faded out. We went into the news, and people would call up and say, hey, wasn't there an ending to that thing anywhere? We would say, hey, it's Citizen Kane. It's a sled. What do you want to know? You know. So we got to the point where we'd show all the endings on Friday. So if you watched the movie during the week, we'd show the ending on Friday. And Rosemary from the Dick Van Dyke Show was coming through town, and she said, that's hysterical. You know? And I said, well, we're actually just fighting for our lives here. We're not really trying to be too humorous. And she took a little piece to Steve Allen that we had done on the show, and he liked it, brought me out. I did three of those. The producer of McHale's Navy saw me, and away it went.
Now, did that not, I mean, did that not intimidate you? I mean, you're coming from Cleveland, and here you're on the hot show, The Tonight Show with Steve Allen, and then all of a sudden you're on this 30-minute sitcom, which becomes a pretty big hit, McHale's Navy.
I'll tell you how much I was unaffected by the business. I was having such a good time in Cleveland. I mean, we had a ball doing this dumb show. It really got to be an inside show.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
People just looked at it because they couldn't believe that these two morons every day attempting to do this show. So I was having so much fun. I went back after doing Steve Allen for three shows. He was doing his Sunday show at that time, and actually it got canceled. So I went back to Cleveland. They called me from here to do McHale's Navy. Or from Cleveland, and I said, geez, I don't think so. I've done Steve Allen. If you do Steve, I figure, where are you going to go after that? So I decided, I would just stay in Cleveland. And the producer general manager, actually, at the station said, you know, you're crazy. You got to go back out there. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. And I said, well, you know, we're having some fun here and whatever. Yeah. So he fired me. He said, well, if the only way you're going to go, I'll fire you. So he fired me, and I went back out there, and that's how it all began.
Wow. I hope you sent him a big check every Christmas.
Oh, I'm in constant touch with him.
My gosh. You know, is there what's the difference in developing the kind of characters that you had to develop on pretty short notice for sketch comedy versus developing a character like Charles Parker on McHale's Navy? What's the difference there?
Well, the Parker character was kind of an invention of mine. I mean, you know, that was my interpretation of what I thought this guy was, and it seemed to fit the script, so you continue to do that. Where on the Burnett Show, for instance, Tudball and Mrs. Wiggins.
Say Mrs. Wiggins for me.
Well, I'll tell you, it's awfully difficult to do. But one of the reasons I ended up doing that voice is because I didn't have to write many lines. It was just the voice that mesmerized people.
I'm sorry.
But that came from a real situation. We had a secretary. I was a writer on the show, and the secretary was down at the end of the hall. So if you wanted something typed, you had to go all the way down the end of the hall and say, Charlene, would you type this? And then you come back, and then she would come down and say, what does this say? I can't read. And you go. You kept going back and forth. So they finally put in an intercom, but it was one of those early things where you just had one button, the talk button and on button. So if you press the talk button while you're talking to somebody, it cut their voice out. So you would say, Charlene, could you come over here? And she'd go, hello? And you go, Charlene, could you just, hello? Charlene, hello? Don't press the talk, hello. So they have to go down there anyway and say, Charlene, don't press the talk button while I'm talking to you. And from that came the first Todd Ball and Wiggins. And I threw that stupid voice in because we always look for that. Toupee and Bob Mackey was great in costumes, put that big rear end on Carol, and away we went.
Many people may not know that you are also on television on a regular basis on one of my favorite shows, SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yes.
My four-year-old niece turned me onto the show several years ago. I love SpongeBob, and you are Barnacle Boy.
Yes, that's true. You know, it's crazy how kids, little kids, I have a granddaughter who's going on 30, but she's 6, and she watches that too, and she was the one who actually pointed out to me that I was on the show, because, you know, in this business, you go in for a voiceover, you read something, and you never know where it's going to go. It could go in a commercial, it could go in a cartoon, it could go wherever. You know, you just sign something and you leave, and the next thing you know, it appears on something. So when I came on SpongeBob, she started saying, Papa, isn't that you on that Barnacle Boy thing? And sure enough, you know, so it's strange how you fall into things out here.
Is there anything that you haven't done that you'd really like to do?
Not really, I swear. I think I've done about everything I had an opportunity to do. I still love to do things that benefits and things that, you know, benefit other people and associations, and I have a couple of charities that I work, that I head, that I'm very involved in, and I think giving back is as important as taking in the beginning, and so I really enjoy going on with it, and I, you know, people call up and say, could you, and I said yes, and they're kind of surprised that you actually do it.
And if you, about a minute left here, but if you hadn't ended up on television and achieved the kind of success that you have, what do you think you would have ultimately done with your life?
I probably would have been a librarian in prison. I think I'd have gotten a pretty good job. Well, I don't actually know. I probably would have been a funny gardener or something. I don't know. You know, just God, that guy's hysterical. He should be on TV.
Tim Conway is going to be in town on Sunday for two shows at 3 and 7 at the Belk Theater at the Blumenthal Performing Arts Center with his erstwhile opponent, Harvey Korman, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten the lady's name.
So have I. Let me think.
Duarte. Duarte.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Louise Duarte.
Good Lord. In a show called Together Again, it's 704-372-1000. It's been absolutely delightful to talk to you. Thank you so much for doing this, Tim Conway.
Thank you, Mike. It was terrific. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening. I'm Mike Collins.